The start of the bank holiday weekend and plenty on the radio, from motorhome scams and fiction laureate Sebastian Barry to dating in the pandemic. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
It seems like, you know, if you went into a bookies or a bank with a shotgun and you stole $7,000, the guards would be onto you quick enough. But with this online kind of thing, it's just the wheels of justice seem to turn a lot slower.
You know, there's people in their 20s, there's people in their 30s, 40s and 50s who we brought on, and I really want to find love for someone in their 60s because there's no age limit on love.
What have you got?
Everything, absolutely everything, and it's payday today, so I treat it myself. Love and life.
And we'll start on the live line. Actor Phelim Drew contacted Joe earlier in the week to tell him he might have been the victim of a scam involving the sale of a motorhome in the UK. And Joe had some bad news for him today.
You see, I was hoping all week that because the Fergus and Sian, who were working on this, at one stage we thought it might be legit, and at one stage we thought you might get your money back. So when we got more calls in today and on foot of what the Sian and Fergus have been doing, I don't think you're going to get your money back, which is a terrible blow to you.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's I suppose where I am with it now is that subsequent to, you know, telling the guards about what happened, and I contacted the police in England, I've been in contact with a member of Europol. Mm-hmm. And I've been in contact with the bank, my bank, and also the bank that I lodged the money to, which is based in Germany. The website had been taken down, mm-hmm. and a few days ago, just out of frustration, I suppose, I looked up the website again, and there it was.
Back up again.
And running.
Yeah.
And it looks really polished, Joe. It looks very mm-hmm. professional, very legit. And it looks very attractive, and that's you know what people could be fooled by, and that's the reason I wanted to come on, not mm-hmm. to sort of air my laundry in public, but really to tell people because there are going to be a lot of people mm-hmm. like us
as we're discovering.
Yeah, I mean, like we're looking at, like, after all the restrictions, people are kind of you know, you can't get a house for love nor money around the country. We've been caravanning we've been camping for years, and we love it. Because you don't have to tell the kids to stop running up and down the corridor, or, you know, to be quiet for other guests or any of that stuff, and they find friends really easily, and it's great crack. So this was a kind of an obvious next step for us, and you know, we're used to getting ripped off on this side of the water, Joe. So mm-hmm. I was looking abroad for a bit of value, and this website, MJ Caravan Sales Limited,
in Tamworth,
made it
in
look,
Tamworth, yeah, in Staffordshire.
Yeah, that's where the address is. Yeah, exactly. You know, so the whole thing is really it's really toxic, you know, and I just want to tell people that if they are kind of tempted to buy a caravan or anything like that, to really think twice about handing over any money. I was on a high. I was thinking, oh, this is how we're going to enjoy our summer. We're going to get away multiple times with the kids. And I decided, you know, it looks really good. I had interactions back and forward through email, and it all looked really kosher, and it wasn't.
And what did you think you were buying, Phelim?
Well, I set out to buy a four-berth caravan. We're a family of six, mm-hmm. and the older boys, we thought, well, we'll throw them out in a tent.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Because they're getting to an age where they don't really want to be coming mm-hmm. away with us that much anyway. And we just wanted something nice. Mm-hmm. And so it was €7,000, Joe. That's what... And I got a loan for that, it's left a sour taste in my mouth. And, you know, obviously I'm not going to stop there. I want to try and get the money back some way or other. It seems like, you know, if you you know, if you went into a bookies or a bank with a shotgun and you stole $7,000, the guards would be onto you quick enough. But with this online kind of thing, it's just the wheels of justice seem to turn a lot slower, you know. And but, you know, we're supposed to be all kind of European and part of a network of care and justice. But it seems to, you know, I've drawn a bit of a blank when I've tried to kind of push things with this.
And Jerry was also caught by the same scam.
Bit similar to Phelan there, about 7,500.
Oh, good God. And when did you lose that?
Well, we lost that on March the 4th. I'll just start the story by saying last year we bought a caravan for the family here.
Yeah.
And we had a beautiful holiday down West Cork in Kerry. This year we decided we'd bring the grandchildren and our daughters, so we decided we'd buy another caravan.
Okay.
And in looking around like Phelan, the values seem to have gone out a bit here in Ireland. They're getting very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, we looked at UK sites. And we ended up looking at the very same site as Phelan. We transferred money on the 4th of March after doing a bit of to-ing and fro-ing.
And what did you think you were buying, Jerry?
Well, we genuinely thought we were buying a nice caravan that we had all the information for, all the photographs and all the detail for it. And I checked out the company, by the way. I checked out the company registration with the company's office in the UK. They were a legitimate company according to this.
We did the same,
Their financial returns were up to date. Everything looked good. Now, that was my naive, maybe, on my part, to accept that as a sort of a bona fide check. But anyway, that was the checking I had done. And we sent our money over. We showed proof that the money had been transferred. We got a delivery date for the caravan. The delivery date came and went. No sign of any caravan. And then we got an email to say the truck had broken down on the road, they were replacing the truck, and then we got a new date, and on the new date, we got an email to say that the driver had tested positive for COVID, so he couldn't come across to Ireland, or he'd have to quarantine, and blah, blah, blah. So then we finally got an email to say, we're very sorry, sir, but we cannot deliver your caravan to Ireland. Can we please have your IBAN number, and we will refund you your money. So we did that. I checked with my bank to know if it was okay to give the IBAN.
Okay.
And they said yes, and give the same IBAN as you transferred the money from. So we did all that, and that's the last we heard from them.
Well, that's Jerry on the live line with Joe Duffy. And if you are thinking about buying a caravan or motorhome from the UK, you can have a listen back to the whole programme on the live line webpage. And on Today with Claire Byrne, people living with obesity and the vaccine rollout. Here's Professor Donal O'Shea, the HSE's National Clinical Lead for Obesity.
Firstly, let's talk about the eligibility criteria for people in this category. Is it your BMI that determines when you will be called, or how does it work?
Yeah, well, there's two, you know, from the start of the pandemic, it became very clear that living with obesity and developing COVID were associated with bad outcomes. And so when the vaccine was being rolled out, had been planned, the HSE involved people living with obesity in the planning to raise awareness. Basically, there's if your body mass index is over 40, and that's how weight is classified. It's your height, it's your weight in kilograms divided by your height in meters squared, but that's complicated. But if your body mass index is over 40, and that's about 20 stone for your average male and about 16 stone for your average height female, then you are in a highly vulnerable group in terms of your outcome from COVID-19.
Okay.
If your body mass index is over 35 and you have complicated obesity, then you're looking at, you're also highly vulnerable and need to get vaccinated early.
Okay, and if anyone is still unclear as to how to work it out, there are lots of BMI calculators available online readily enough, aren't
Absolutely.
There?
Absolutely, just BMI calculator and you'll calculate your BMI in a couple of seconds.
Because the problem is, and you've expressed concerns, as I said, about this, that people may not know that they're in these categories.
Yeah, I mean it's complicated because people are in denial about their weight themselves. Weight is still very much stigmatized, despite the health system clearly recognizing it as a chronic disease. The European Commission recognizing obesity as a chronic disease. People still blame themselves, and people still are judged. And healthcare professionals underestimate people's weight. So the only way to know your weight is to actually have it measured or measure it yourself.
And people who are living with obesity, are they self-identifying in normally, or are they identified through primary care, GP or practice nurse?
Yeah, and you know, that's one of the challenges at the moment. There are people living with obesity going to their GPs, and the GPs are kind of saying, well, look, no, it's back to the HSE. We haven't smoothed out the path to vaccination for people living with obesity. We need an awareness campaign. Most people will be identified in primary care, but only if they're weighed and measured. Hospital clinics that do weigh and measure, like our own, will be able to provide that list. But the first step is to find out what your weight is. Do you qualify for an early vaccine? And then approach your GP and make them aware of that.
Okay, but you're saying that it may not be the GP who will administer the vaccine?
I think that at the moment that isn't clear, because the where of it in time, it certainly will be, because the bottom line is with maybe 8 to 10% of our population with that BMI over 35. So a lot of that vaccination is going to need to happen in the primary care environment.
And it's really crucial that people who are in this cohort are vaccinated, because you referred to the outcomes for people who are living with obesity. If they contract COVID, they can be very, very serious.
Well, absolutely. And there was a paper published in the Lancet this morning that shows that from the age of 20 on, the link with living with obesity and outcome in COVID is clear. Per literally stone you put on, you are more likely to end up in hospital and much more likely to end up in intensive care. So it's critical that we have an awareness campaign that will encourage people to self-identify, and that then we have access to the vaccine for people living with obesity.
Professor Donal O'Shea from Today with Claire Byrne. And in Northern Ireland, it was a new pants day for many. Laura Hogan was reporting from Belfast.
It's a big day for Northern Ireland today, as the most significant phase of the reopening so far gets underway. And there really is an atmosphere and air of activity that has been missing in the city for many months. But keen shoppers, eager for some retail therapy, brought that atmosphere back in buckets this morning. People have been arriving to Primark on Castle Street since around 6 a.m. The shop opened just after 7, and that was earlier than planned to manage social distancing. And hundreds of people, it has to be said, showed up to get their wares. Now, it's still early, but the shoppers didn't mind that at all, and I've been speaking to some of them.
Welcome back to Primark. Enjoy.
We opened at 6:45 because there was a few waiting outside, and rather than have a lot for the social distancing and stuff, we opened the doors to get the footfall in, quicker out for more people to get in then.
So it's just after 7:30. You already have your bags, shopping bags, full here. Tell me what you got this morning.
Just socks and underwear. All the basics.
And what brought you out so early?
I'm off work today and she booked the day off work. But we actually thought it opened at 8, but then everyone was walking about Primark bags, so we like rushed in, but it's mad now. But we got in just before the queue started.
Great stuff. And you're now in the queue for Zara, so yep. You have more on the list.
Yes, definitely.
What about you? What did you pick up today?
Just all the basics I've been running out of. I had holes in all my socks, so new socks and pyjamas.
What have you got?
Everything. Absolutely everything, and it's payday today, so I treated myself. We came down at 6:30 this morning and straight in, so we were able to get our sizes and stuff. Loving life.
Is retail therapy one of the things that you've missed the most?
Oh, definitely. Trying to get underwear as well. See, trying to get my size, but love it.
We're here to get clothes. We've waited months for Primark to reopen again, so we have. Underwear, jammies. That'd be it, really.
Is shopping the thing that you've missed the most during all of this, or what is it?
In-store shopping, yeah, because you can't do the same online. So you can't, online shopping, you can't pick your sizes properly because you don't know whether it's going to fit or not. And then you have to wait in returns and everything else, where at least when you're in-store shopping, you can pick what you want.
What time did you get up at this morning?
I got up about 6 o'clock.
Are you normally up that early?
No, I haven't been up that early since my last holiday, which was about 2 years ago.
Do you think it will be worth it?
Oh, let's hope so. Everyone's coming out with big bags, so I'm worried about like the size and not being there, but we'll see.
And what are you after this morning?
Anything I can get my hands on.
Laura Hogan's report from Morning Ireland. And in the morning, Izzy was talking to Ryan Tuberty about dating during the pandemic. But before we get to all the love stuff, Ryan wanted to know about that name.
Izzy Bartak Healy.
Yes.
That is quite the name you got there.
Yes, the Bartak is Hungarian, so it comes from my mother's side.
Amazing.
So we would have called my granddad Nudge Papa.
Nudge Papa, Nudge Papa, Nudge Papa, that's why it goes. Bartak. And yeah. have you been? Did you trace it down? Have you been to Hungary? Is it? You mean do you care about the Hungarian strain in your family?
Of course. So I went to Budapest there about 5 years ago, which is where my Nudge Papa was born, and then he went to Australia. And then do you know what? There's actually a really beautiful love story between himself and my granny.
Okay, so people are going, "Why? Who is this woman?" And I said, well, you wrote into us that you've got this dating thing on Instagram going on, and we're going to go there in a second. But actually, it's completely appropriate that you tell me about a love story that goes behind this. Go, keep going. You're doing great.
Okay, so basically, right, so they're in Australia. My Nudge Papa sees my granny Mary, and he says, oh, I really like the look of her. Like, you know, I really want to take her out on a date. Yeah. But Mary's brother was very protective, and he said, no, you're not taking my sister out on a date. And he was like, okay. And he didn't see her for ages, and they kind of lost contact with one another. He traveled to all of the dances all over Australia looking for her, couldn't find her anywhere.
Yeah.
And then, Ryan, a year later, they were set up on a blind date.
Like just complete random.
Complete random.
No.
Got married, had a bunch of kids, like moved to the UK, then to Ireland, and yeah, beautiful love story.
Nudge Papa.
Yeah.
Why Nudge Papa?
So it's Hungarian for granddad.
Is it really? And how do you spell it? Like nudge?
I think so. Yeah. I'm actually not 100% sure.
No, but you're so used to calling that, you never thought about spelling it. It's just Nudge Papa. That's how he is. And they fell in love, and then and now we're here on the radio on a Friday as a direct result of Nudge Papa's A, love for your grandmother, but B, the fates refusing to allow him not to be with her.
Absolutely. And in a way, Ryan, it's kind of trying, you know, I'm trying to do that for people now at the moment, if you get what I'm saying.
I do, because Izzy Match Busy.
Yes.
That's your kind of showbiz name.
Yeah, so basically, like, people know me as Izzy Showbizzy, right? So I was trying to do a play on words.
Oh, God.
And I just kind of ran with it, to be honest.
Okay. We might work on that, but it's a good start, right? Okay. So tell us about yourself, Izzy. What's the story?
Right. So, like, I've been working in, like, the media industry for years. Mm. And this whole Izzy Match Busy thing came about because, you know, I'm very active on my Instagram, Ryan. You know, it's the app that I love, you know, more than Facebook and Twitter and everything.
I like
else.
It too. I agree with you. It's a warm, friendly place to be.
Yeah. And like, I love interacting with my Instagram followers. And they basically said to me, Izzy, it is so hard to date at the moment. Like, it's hard to date in general, but throw in a pandemic, you know, you can't go to a restaurant. It's quite hard to meet people.
Mm.
So I thought to myself, okay, how can I help people? How can I put on a show that can potentially help people find love? And therefore, Izzy Match Busy was created. So I'm producing, presenting and researching the first ever Instagram Live matchmaking show. And I've been doing it bi-weekly on my Instagram, which is Izzy_showbusy. And it's been incredibly successful. I'm delighted.
How does it work in practice?
So basically, right, for instance, Ryan, if you wanted to come on now, you would chat to me for 5 minutes and, you know, you tell me a little bit about yourself. So where you're from, what you do, what you like, what you don't like. And the idea is, right, we get you a match from who is watching. So, you know, it's different to everything else that's going on. I'm not directly matching you up with someone. it's all about who's watching. So if someone likes you, they're going, oh, I like a little bit of Ryan there, right? So they're able to slide on into your DMs afterwards, your direct messages.
Mm-hmm.
And what I say to people is, because that can be a little bit daunting, okay?
Mm.
So I always say to people, if you like the look of someone on the show, just say, hey, really liked you on Is He Match Busy? And then, like, open the conversation from there.
Right, you don't have to say, hey, how's it going? Let's get married.
Yeah, that might be a little bit too forward.
Bit quick, maybe a little previous.
I'd start with something smaller, just like, hey, you were great.
And Izzy is looking for new dating candidates.
So if anyone would like to come on the show, I would absolutely adore to hear from you.
Yeah.
And all they have to do is message me on my Instagram, Izzy_showbusy, and we'll try and get them on the next episode. But basically, So I would say to you, like, you know, where are you from? What do you do? And then we kind of get a feel for you, because I like to bring on a totally different range of people. So, you know, there's people in their 20s, there's people in their 30s, 40s and 50s who we brought on. And I really want to find love for someone in their 60s, because there's no age limit on love. You know, so that was so important to me as well, to just help people and, you know, to provide a bit of entertainment for a Saturday evening. So we asked them, you know, a bit about themselves, and we try and get a sense for, like, who they want to slide on into their direct messages afterwards. So, like, some girls are funny and they're like, I don't like any guys under 5'7". You know, if you're under 5'7", not interested. And then other people are just like, do you know what? I'm in my 40s. You know, I've had this type of person and that type of person. I'm just looking for someone that's kind. Mm. And that's really come across through the episodes as well.
Really?
Is that, like, you know, people are just looking for someone that, you know, to watch TV with, you know, to watch The Late Late Show with on a Friday night, curl up on the couch, to do those kinds of things with. And I think people,
they must
have
be really
moved
desperate.
On.
No. So things have moved on from what? I mean, the obvious, is it?
Yeah, so, like, you know, it's a conversation as well, I think, you know, that's opening to that. You know, dating apps, they can work for some people, but they don't work for everyone. And I think that's what's so different about Is He Match Busy, is because, you know, you get a sense of someone by the way they smile, the way they laugh, you know. You're not just swiping left or right on Tinder. That
yes.
can be a bit soulless.
So it's bringing someone to life then. So you're kind of getting to see a bit of their look in the whites
exactly.
of the eyes.
And it's great at the moment, you know, helping people find love during a pandemic. But I think there's a future for this, Ryan. You know, I'd love to make it into a TV show. Can you make that happen?
We could certainly. I think if I was a producer person in TV land, I'd be listening attentively. And I think
Ooh.
That you certainly would have what it takes, if you ask me. And you're obviously very good at it. Do you have a good strike rate in terms of matching people?
So the whole matching situation is, obviously, it's been harder with people to see each other with restrictions. But what I will say is I have been on to previous contestants. There has been some matches and there's been a lot of flirting, right? Do you know, there's been a lot of messaging.
Mm.
And there was one person that was on my last episode and he had 100 messages after he came on the show.
And was he a handsome devil?
He was a handsome devil. And what I will say as well while I'm here is it is harder to recruit men than it is women. So if there's any men that are listening right now and, you know, they want to come on, bit of crack for Saturday night.
This happens in everything, whether it's Dan. As long as I'm sitting here, Izzy, I hear people who are dancing classes. Men, no, it's just women have to dance with women because the men just won't show up. Dating, anything to do with dating. Men are, they love Tinder or whatever because it's just like left, right. There's no,
yeah.
you know, and then there's, and even whatever, there's a gathering. It's just like, lads, come on, get up.
I know.
Get busy.
This is it. And we've had some fantastic matches for men. Like, the men do really, really well out of it.
Yeah.
So, you know, there's nothing stopping them. And I think, isn't there nothing more attractive than a man putting themselves out there? Because women love it. Like, so confident being able to go on a live matchmaking show. Like, what a catch.
Izzy Bartak-Healy from The Ryan Tubridy Show. And on Today with Claire Byrne, laureate for Irish fiction Sebastian Barry at the end of his tenure. In his time as laureate, he set up book clubs in prisons and direct provision centres, supported new writing and gave many talks and lectures. His latest one focuses on family.
I read your talk yesterday, the copy of it. It's called The Fog of Family. Will you explain to me what you mean by the fog in this instance?
Well, this is a lecture I was hoping to complete for the first year, and it proved very difficult thing to do. And I spent the last 3 years going back to it and back to it to try and at least get it as right as I could get it. It's basically about those years that remain mysterious between maybe 2 and 12, not just for writers but for everybody, where, you know, you are a child and you are, in a sense, receiving the great tsunami of experiences, in particular from your family. And in my own case, obviously, I do believe that's what makes a person into a writer, their experiences in that time. There's a huge fogginess to the time, though. It is a landscape occluded by secrets and mysteries. And I think what I didn't understand, in a way, was that it's the fog that's important to the writer, rather than those moments in your childhood or in your life when the fog clears,
mm-hmm.
because you're always trying to peer into it.
Very many people look back on their childhoods and they say, I had a very happy childhood. It's about poking that bear, isn't it? And asking yourself, well, when was I happy? When was I not happy? And why?
And, you know, to be honest, and to be honest about it, which is very difficult. I mean, the truth about my books is, those 8 books, which are supposedly about my family, I read it so often, I believe it myself. But actually, most of them are invented people. But these are the real people. I mean, the two strands of the books would be the Dunn family and the McNulty family. In the real world, those people come together. Those families come together with the marriage of my parents, for instance.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's sort of the book you don't write. And the lecture is really looking at that. I mean, my mother was a stupendous individual. I mean, just this colossus of a person in the theatre. And in many ways, you know, was an extravagantly interesting mother to have. But there's other sides to it. And if you don't have a reckoning with those things, you actually are unable fully to love them. You know, you mustn't be lying to yourself about what things were like. And that's what I found, that those 3 years struggling with it brought me to a new understanding myself. Let alone trying to get other people to have an understanding of it, of my family.
And you're clearly mad about both your parents and how you describe them, particularly during your childhood years, the little hand reaching out to touch your dad's beard. We might talk about that relationship and how it developed more in a moment.
Mm.
But you describe them as being negatively charged.
Mm.
What does that mean?
Well, it's just a simple piece of chemistry, really, physics. My grandparents, especially my great-aunt Annie, but also my two grandfathers. I didn't know my grandmothers. They had died, but were, while very complicated people, I mean, like everybody, Claire, you know, these are not unique individuals in any way, but the child looks forensically at these people, and they were very, very, for me, positively charged. They gave me, especially my grandfather, painter, whose portrait I have in front of me as I'm speaking to you, gave me a whole world of possible, the thing I might possibly do. He thought I might be a painter, but, you know, I did become a painter by other means. So they're always, and indeed, my mother also was, you know, put a pencil in my hand at the age of 2 weeks or something and bit me, apparently, I don't remember, either to paint or to draw or to write, she said. Draw with this or write with this. You know, so there was, you know, it isn't, it's just to get that balance. And when you, looking at it forensically, you know, in its almost chemistry way, to be able to say that ultimately there were minuses there that were troubling for a child and difficult for a child and for the grown up as well. And even though I adored those two people, I mean, the love of any child, I've been reading a lot about, for instance, the experiences of people in industrial schools. And it's obvious that even when the most violent of brothers or priests were softened by Christmas and were kinder to the boys, that's when, you know, the gates of love are opened immediately. It's really quite extraordinary, both how resilient the child is, but also the magnificence of their love.
And Claire asked Sebastian about his parents' separation.
I should mention, of course, your mother, many people will know, was Joan O'Hara, the actress. Your parents separated and you lost touch with your father to a large extent for a very long period of time, was it?
Mm. Yeah, I mean, we're more or less on the same island, but the gap between estranged family members it can be as if one is in the remotest part of Australia and the other is in Ireland, you know. These are thoughts I have, you know, every day I wake. I have to acknowledge that that's the case. And I have to acknowledge, you know, for instance, my brother, whom I absolutely adored as when he was a little boy, he was 13 years younger than me. I also seem to be estranged from him. Now, I'm beginning to conclude, Claire, that there's something to do with me more than with them, because there is kind of a flight away from poor old Sebastian. But, I regard these things as my share of, a tragic circumstance in the world. My own family that I made with Ali, or she made it, I sort of helped her now, that I regard as the boon of my life. I mean, as the great medicine of my life. So, I'm not in any way disadvantaged from day to day. But I have to recognize that there's been a sort of distant sense of, not carnage, but a sort of intimate slaughter of the usual relationships between people. But having not had these relationships ongoing, I have to say, I have an immense appreciation, and I not only envy, but I celebrate the people who do have loving relationships ongoing with their parents. I do think that is one of the most magical things you can possess.
And did you recover any of that relationship when you met him then in recent years, in his older years in Greece, as you describe?
Not temporally, you know, not to lift a phone or anything. Mm-hmm. But you have to also settle for the shard of goodness that you can get out of it. You must settle for that. Because Kant's been talks beautifully about this sort of thing. You know, you must never go home to your parents and be giving out to them. Because when they're very old, he's, you know, what's the point of that? And that sounds like, that's when he first said that, I thought, not so sure. But now I think I know what he means.
Okay.
Like, you have to access a sort of, I don't know, a sort of heart grandeur in yourself to continue to love people from whom you are estranged. But it is necessary. It is necessary. It is essential. I mean, just from the level of human endeavour and on the ongoingness of being a human person to do that.
And Claire asked Sebastian about what he's working on now.
I spent a year also reading about the history of slavery in North America and indeed elsewhere. I think what I'm trying to, having had three children myself, and one additional sort of adopted child, we labored to give them a safe place to be. That seemed to me the ultimate thing. And I'm looking at those sites, particularly in Ireland, where people weren't safe. And it's just the idea of 7 or 8 year old girl or boy with no one to defend them being attacked in every sense that I'm preoccupied with for some reason. So it may be because I'm trying to sing towards it and find some way to embody it in a novel. I'm just not quite sure at this point.
It's just, it's hard to contemplate those images, but so important that we know it.
Very important. Because we're a child as a country in a way. You know, we're only getting into our teens as a country.
Yes.
So 1922, you know, we're just growing up and we've made great strides. And I mean, as having lived here all my life and just looking around me, having been truly slightly terrorized as coming back from England as a little boy, coming back into this Catholic world, you know, the strides are immense. And I think the mere fact that a lot of people of the newer generations don't even think about Irish history is in its own strange way a beneficent thing, because it's not gnawing at their feet. You know.
Sebastian Barry from Today with Claire Byrne. Now, it would be nice to be going out this weekend, wouldn't it? On the news at 1, Cian McCormick was looking to the UK and their pilot plans for live events.
This is the sound of Relative Freedom. A concert with 5,000 unvaccinated attendees in Barcelona last month. Since then, according to Spanish doctors, there's no sign of COVID-19 infections stemming from the concert.
We can be sure that this has not been a super spreading event because there's no sign that the incidence of SARS-CoV-2 infection was increased.
Yesterday, Minister Catherine Martin talked of piloting large indoor and outdoor events. It's still not clear when this will happen, and her department didn't have any further details today when contacted by News at One. The Event Industry Alliance welcomes the proposals but wants more details. Its chairman, Dan McDonnell.
I suppose we broadly welcome the thought process of the minister. We would encourage them to engage with us further in terms of looking at these pilot events. They are extremely important and would go towards the opening of the wider industry in Ireland.
While we wait in Ireland for more details, in Liverpool this weekend, 5,000 people will gather for a music festival. It will be headlined by Blossoms. Claire McColgan, Director of Culture Liverpool.
And it's hugely exciting for us. It's the first music event that's happened, the first outdoor music festival that's happened in the country. We've got a nightclub happening tonight for the first time. We've never opened nighttime in this country. So it's a massive, massive deal for the city and the country, actually, because these event pilots will pave the way for how we open up the sector nationally.
There are safeguards in place for the concerts and the nightclub as well.
There are lots of safeguards in place because we're operating a lateral flow system before you go in. So you've got to take a lateral flow test and answer a questionnaire, because this is all part of a scientific experiment as to how we get the sector open safely. But once you are inside, there is no social distancing, no masks. So it's as real as it would have been a year and a half ago.
A follow-up PCR test 5 days after the gig.
5 days after a follow-up PCR test, and the negative lateral flow test is linked to your ticket. So your ticket only gets validated once you've had that negative lateral flow test. So it's a whole new system that we've worked out here in Liverpool to get the sector up and running.
The concert is not being held in isolation. It involves other events. What are the other events that have happened or are happening?
So we did a business event, which is to look at opening up business conferencing, hugely important for our city and for the country. So that happened on Wednesday. Really, really successful. Very interesting to see how people started very nervous, and then by the end of it, it was like COVID hadn't happened. People were interacting how they would have done a year and a half ago.
Matthew Ashton, Liverpool City Council's Director of Public Health, says what's happening in Liverpool is part of the British government's event research programme.
So it's a part of a series of events across the whole country, and the scientists collect all the information, all the intelligence arising from those events, and take it into recommendations into government to inform future policy and strategy. In effect, how do we safely reopen this sector in the future?
Epidemiologists in Ireland would look at what you're doing in Liverpool and say, well, we could do that here, but we need to wait for lower case numbers. At what level is a safe level to run a scientific experiment like this?
It's a great question. Right now in Liverpool, the rates are really low. Actually, our rate's around 13 per 100,000. So anything around 20 per 100,000 means you've got 1 in 5,000 positive cases. So the risk is actually quite low. And of course, this is a scientific experiment. There are controls in place.
DCU professor and epidemiologist Anthony Stain says to run an experiment like the one in Liverpool, we need lower COVID-19 numbers in Ireland.
It's a model approach for figuring out when can we go to larger events. At the moment, the risk of going to larger events here is probably significant. But if we're going to do it, then the kind of things they're doing are the kind of things we're going to have to do here. So we can learn a lot from watching what they're doing.
Cian McCormick's report for the News at One. And in the morning, Taoiseach Micheál Martin on the latest plan for easing COVID-19 restrictions. He was speaking to Mary Wilson.
There is a lot of optimism about this morning. There's hope and caution and people already making plans. But these are not toddler steps that you've announced over the last 24 hours. They are fairly significant steps forward. Will you give us some insight into the plan and how you and NPHET have balanced the science, the modelling with the risk?
Yes, and first of all, NPHET are very clear that what we're now planning and doing and so on and have announced is low to medium risk. That is the assessment of NPHET, and in his presentation, that's how Tony Holohan would have described it to the Cabinet Subcommittee the evening before last, and indeed Philip Nolan also did some modelling. And so it's cautious, it's phased, and if you look at the month of May in particular, it's in line with the type of areas that we flagged at the end of April. So, you know, retail, but fully reopening on the 17th of May, click and collect on the 10th. Similarly, with personal services and also then religious services, but all, mm-hmm. again, with strong sectoral guidance. And all will, you know, all of us depending in terms of our individual behaviours and collective behaviours to make this work. But I think the people so far since Christmas have responded extremely well to the guidance and to the regulations. And that in the main has been the key factor in where we are now. And we are ahead really of where we probably thought we would be in terms of the number of cases, hospitalisations and ICUs. Mm. So that's the platform upon which we base this phased reopening.
OK, tell us a little bit more about the modelling. On the 10th of May, we'll have inter-county travel returning, personal services, 50-ish religious services, funerals and weddings, and then a further unwinding on May 17th and on June 2nd and 7th proceeding further. But along all those stages, if you see numbers spiking, if you see hospital admissions increasing, is that when the emergency brake kicks in?
Yes, I mean, basically we will monitor this and we will take steps if steps are necessary, because the overriding consideration will always be the protection of public health and life. And in that context, Ireland has done well, relatively speaking, so far in this pandemic compared to others. And also the overwhelming of the hospital and healthcare system all over the world is always a key metric. Now, the good news is we're 136 in hospital today with COVID, 44 in ICU as we begin today. And that's good news. I mean, that is very good news. And I think we have taken the pressure off the health service. Mm. The vaccination programme then is the other key factor here, which is having a transformative impact on the cohorts that have been vaccinated so far. So the evidence is good in terms of reducing severe illness, reducing mortality, and indeed transmission amongst those who have been vaccinated, and that's both here and across the world.
If those metrics start to go wrong on you, if those numbers you're talking about in hospitals and ICUs, if that R number starts to increase, what are you going to do? What is the plan? Is it for localised lockdowns? What does the emergency brake actually mean?
Well, first of all, there are two phases here. The first phase, the month of May, which is gradual, and which will bring key sectors back into play and people back to work and businesses back into operation who desperately need to get back into operation in terms of future viability. But we will, you know, in the past we have intervened, you know, we've delayed reopenings and so on. But I would be more than hopeful that we can see May through. We will assess it towards the end of May in terms of what, you know, in terms of June and beyond June. So I would be hopeful. And I actually would believe, and given the evidence so far in terms of how people have behaved and that these particular sectors have very strong guidance attached to how they will reopen, I think we're in a good space. Mm. We will not be afraid to intervene, in short, if there are worrying trends
right,
in this.
Well, that's Taoiseach Micheál Martin with Mary Wilson from Morning Ireland. Then later, Claire Byrne was talking to Health Minister Stephen Donnelly.
We are not used to good news, and the government is not used to good news. I just wanted to ask you about Wednesday night's Cabinet Subcommittee briefing. What was the atmosphere, the vibe like in there? I mean, you heard the recommendations from NPHET. You wouldn't be used to hearing positive recommendations from NPHET, right?
Not in some time. No, it's been a brutal year for the country. It's been so hard for people in terms of mental health, isolation, loneliness. It's been such a difficult year. And because of my role, and I, you know, Tony Holohan and I work about three doors down from each other in the Department of Health in Ronan Glynon, we would have been discussing all of this in the lead up to this.
And so you had an inkling that good news was coming in terms of their recommendations before you walked into that meeting?
Certainly, yeah. But nonetheless, the recommendations were very well received. I think a sense of relief for everybody, certainly in that room, because ultimately, cabinet has had to make decisions that no one ever wants to make. Awful decisions that have awful impacts on people in terms of isolation and loneliness and business and economy, and so many difficult things have had to have been done. So to be presented with a very positive picture was fantastic. And, you know, I for me, I really feel very proud of our nation right now, because the reason we can have the conversation we're all having this morning, and the reason people can feel this sense of relief, is because over the last while, the country has acted together to drive this virus down. So 4 weeks ago, we had a similar COVID committee meeting, and the forecasts we were given by NPHET showed that things could get really quite bad, really quite quickly. And the best case scenario we saw was that the cases would go up to 1,000 a day, that the R number, the best R number, would be 1.2. And we sent a very strong message out, and our doctors, our clinicians, NPHET sent a very strong message out at that time saying we gotta step up once more. And as a nation, not only did we stop the cases going up, but we actually pushed them back down again. Mm-hmm. Now, they are stepping up again now, but that's why we've been able to have that conversation.
So Dr. Holohan said, didn't he, that the option that you've gone for, this is low to medium risk. Was there any push and pull there? Was there anybody, and I'm asking about Dr. Holohan as well, who was saying we should be going for low risk really here until we get the vaccinations up to 40, 50% of the population?
Well, this was the package that was presented to us. So NPHET didn't come and say, look, here's a low risk option, here's a medium risk option, and here's a higher risk option. This was the one package that was presented. And based on their analysis, as I was saying, because of the effort everyone has gone to push the virus down, and because of the amazing impact of the vaccine program, we were able to have a very positive conversation, which they believe is still low to medium risk.
Okay. And what level are we going to be at now? Like, do the levels exist anymore? Because this is really important, in particular for employers when they're assessing risk in the workplace, isn't it?
Yeah, the levels, to be honest, you could make an argument that we're at, you know, we'll be moving. We know we're at level 5, and you could make an argument that we're moving, you know, to a 3+ or a 4-. I think at this point, it's probably better to just look at the measures that have been announced, because some of them.
So the levels are gone, really, is what you're saying. If you haven't had a conversation at the level that you operate about what level we're heading for, we probably can discount them altogether, that system.
I think to an extent we can. I think as an architecture, it's still very useful to have there. But certainly one of the things I was doing was highlighting it for each of the categories, what level we're going to. And the reality is, for some it's 2, for others it's 3, for others it's 4. So I think at this point, it's a very useful architecture to have in the back of our minds. But really, we should just look at what the measures are
and
what's being relaxed.
Levels.
Exactly.
Health Minister Stephen Donnelly from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ray Darcy Show, some very excited grandparents. Ethna Reynolds was talking to Ray.
Now we go to Sligo and we say hello to Ethna Reynolds. How are you doing, Ethna?
I'm very well, thanks, Ray.
Is it Drumsulla?
Drumsukla.
Oh, Drumsukla. Oh, so it's not a silent GH. You actually say
no,
the G.
No.
Yeah. And whereabouts in Sligo is that, Ethna?
It's just into County Sligo. We're on the borders of Roscommon and Sligo.
Okay. Now, the big emotional story of lockdown for me was the separation of grandparents from their grandchildren.
Yes, very emotional for us too, Ray.
Yeah, yeah. How many grandchildren have you got?
I have 6.
Yourself and Tom have 6 grandchildren, right?
That's right, yeah. We have Sean, who's 9.
Right.
And we have Karen, who's 6. Tara, 4. Patrick, 4. Niamh, 2. And baby Niall is 8 months.
Right. Now, how much time have you been in the company of baby Niall?
At his christening.
That's it. That's it.
Yes.
Right.
And at that time, Ray, there were only 7 people allowed at the christening.
Hmm. So important people had to stay out as a result.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes, all the aunties and uncles and their children. No children allowed.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it was hard.
So he's 9 months old now. And
yes.
He hasn't got a clue who you are, Ethna. I'm sorry to say
it,
but that's...
Oh, he has no idea. No. We talked to them on FaceTime, but... Yeah. He's smiling and he's clapping his hands.
Yeah.
And he has 2 teeth.
But you know, the bonding thing depends an awful lot on scent, on your smell, you know. And
yes,
that's
what, absolutely, that, yeah.
That's what babies pick up on. So they'd know, yes. Although they wouldn't be able to articulate it, they'd know granny smell and they'd know yes. granddad smell. And, you know, so that's big news when things open up on the 10th. So a lovely piece in by Maurice McDonough in the Times today.
Yes.
So who's in the picture there?
My husband Tom and our grandson Patrick.
Aha, so he's Niall's older brother.
Yes, and he's from Ballybuffet in Donegal.
And prior to lockdown, what was the visiting arrangements?
My son Mark and his family came every Friday.
Every Friday?
Yes, and Mark helped out in the farming, and of course the children had fun with granny and granddad.
Yeah.
Spins on the tractor,
yeah.
Walks to the lake.
Ah, lovely.
All that kind of thing.
And have you got animals? Have you got animals?
Oh, we have cows and calves, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you were a huge part of their lives?
Yes, yes.
And vice versa?
And vice versa.
Yeah, yeah. How has it been for yourself and Tom then?
It was lonely. The week was very long. We missed out on the weekends from the Dublin gang.
Would they come up as well from
the
weekend?
They used to come from Dublin every couple of weeks.
Right. And that'd be John and that's the son, and Sean is the grandson, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, Sean and Karen and Tara.
Right, yeah.
And we missed out on all the birthdays last year. And it's not the same putting money in a card.
No.
As going to the party and having the cake. And
are you a big... Would you bring cake with you, or what way does it work?
Oh, yes, grannies always bring cakes.
Right. What's your speciality?
Chocolate biscuit.
Oh, I love that, chocolate biscuit cake.
Yeah, and cupcakes with loads of sprinkles.
Right, OK. I'd say the sugar count now from granny is quite high, is it?
You're allowed when you're in granny's house.
Edna Reynolds on The Ray D'Arcy Show. Now, English spelling might be changing. Spelling reform systems came up on Today with Claire Byrne.
Changes to how we spell everyday words could be on the horizon if spelling reformers in Britain manage to convince academics and teachers that their system is superior. But why? Well, let me read you an extract from a poem called The Chaos to demonstrate the absurdities of English spelling. Beware of herd, a dreadful word that looks like beard and sounds like bird, and dead, it said like bed, not bead. For goodness sakes, don't call it deed. And that goes on and on and on with more and more examples of how spelling can be confusing in the English language. Well, I'm joined on the line by Stephen Lindstedt, who's a member of the English Spelling Society and author of Traditional Spelling Revised. You're very welcome, Stephen. We'll be joined in a moment by Des Ryan, who has a PhD in linguistics and is a linguist for Apple. But Stephen, you believe that the English language is broken.
I don't believe the English language is broken. I do believe the English spelling has got severe deficiencies. It's basically the spelling system of English is the most irregular and unpredictable of all spelling systems based on the alphabetic principle. With most languages, most spelling systems, at least you know how to pronounce a word from the spelling. You don't with English. Not merely can you not predict the spelling from hearing the word, you can't always know how to pronounce from seeing it written. This double whammy is probably unique to English. And this does have practical effects. This is not just quaintness. For example, it's been found that English-speaking school children take more than 2 years longer on average to master basic spelling compared with those in other languages. And we contend this has social and economic costs.
So are you talking about using phonetics to spell words?
We're talking about making English spelling more predictable. The particular scheme which has been voted on by the International English Spelling Congress, in which I authored, is the conservative scheme. It only makes changes where these are necessary to reduce ambiguity or to get rid of some of the failures of English spelling. It respells about 8 to 18% of existing words, depending on the context.
What about silent letters then, Stephen? I'm thinking of the word Nash, so G-N-A-S-H. That would become, that would lose its G in, under your system, would it?
Yes, under TSR and under other spelling reform systems, one drops the redundant letters. You can, if you want, under TSR, put an apostrophe in if you want, particularly if that might help to distinguish letters that sound the same, like our. If you, for the part, the period of time, you could put an apostrophe in instead of the H to distinguish with from our, as in our property.
And Des Ryan, PhD in linguistics and linguist for Apple, also spoke to Claire about spelling reform.
You know, the reality is nothing is going to change in formal spelling, you know, at the moment. You know, whatever people do in text messaging, and a lot of that, you know, 20 years ago, there was a lot of that happening. But nowadays, you get more creativity in names and in places where, you know, you get in spellings outside of dictionary spellings is where the interesting stuff happens. But amongst, let's say, dictionary spellings, normal spellings, there's very little chance that things will change. And any the effect of text messaging of, say, 15, 20 years ago has really been put to bed by predictive text, because nowadays it's not as cool, I suppose, to misspell words as it once was, mm-hmm. at least amongst younger people.
Yeah. The English language is tricky, though, isn't it? I mean, I was teaching my seven-year-old how to spell frightening the other day, which was on his list of words. It is very hard to explain why there is a GH in the middle of that word.
Yeah, I'd say it was quite a frightening experience.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean,
for him and me.
Yeah, no, I can imagine. My son is a little younger. He can spell letters, but he can't spell whole words. And I haven't got to that stage yet. He's nearly four. And you're right. It's quite a frightening experience because I suspect it will. I mean, if you come back to me in a year or so, or a couple of years, I'll know more about what it's like to teach kids. But I think the question for something like that is, you have to ask why these things happened, and I think it would be very helpful if more people knew the reasons behind the irregularities of the spelling.
Des Ryan from Today with Claire Byrne. And thanks to Ryan Tuberty for this earworm.
It's like my fridge. If I leave my fridge door open for long enough, it goes di-ding, di-ding, di-ding. And of course, every time, and the girls mock me for it, because I hear di-ding, di-ding, di-di-di-ding, di-ding. Ding, ding, which is the theme to Mr. Men. This is my life. This is my head. Welcome.
Yes, you're right. That's not Mr. Men. Tanya was on the ball.
Thank you, Tanya. You're quite right. My fridge door, and I was going, ba-bam, 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 bam. I said it's like Mr. Men. She said, no, you're thinking of the Flumps. And she's right. My fridge door sounds like the Flumps. That's it.
Rest of the weekend, that'll be in my head. Thanks, Ryan. And that's it from Playback Daily. So mind yourself till next time.